Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, and I'm glad to be back behind the microphone and glad to be with you. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, and we've got a lot to talk about. First, I want to thank Dr. Russell Moore, my guest host, for doing a fantastic job during the month of July, and he really kept it going, and I really appreciate him as a colleague and his willingness to take this on, and he's just really good at it. I know you enjoyed him and the conversation you had over the last month, and as we look to the future, this week we've got a lot to talk about. Today, we're going to be talking about a story in today's edition of the New York Times. It's just one of those things you got to talk about. It's an article entitled, Men Not Working and Not Wanting Just Any Job. It's about men, middle-aged men, men as the article describes them at the prime of their life, who've just decided that work is beneath them. We're going to be talking today about a Christian understanding of the responsibility of a man to work. Real work. Remunerative work. Work that makes a contribution to society and work that provides for his household. I want to give you a heads up on that. You can go to the website of the New York Times. That's nytimes.com. Take a look at the article yourself and get ready to talk about it. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about who makes the decisions about medical care for your children. Story out of Virginia about a young man. I wrote about it, blog entry, a lot of controversy. I got a lot of email about this, having to do with a young man who is refusing a second round of chemotherapy with the support of his parents and has now been confronted by a social worker and by a court who says that they're going to have to go through the chemotherapy. There have been some legal twists and turns in recent days. We'll update you on the story tomorrow, but this is a big one. Who makes the decisions for your child? You may find that you and some of your best friends will disagree about this one. We're going to talk about why, what are the Christian worldview implications, what are the role of parents, and just how do we understand the legal context here and our response to it. On Wednesday, of course, it's going to be Ask Anything Wednesday, and we'll talk about what's on your mind. On Thursday, we're going to talk about gambling. Big issue right now. It is the fastest growing avocational phenomenon, that is to say, fun and gaming activity among the young. College students getting ready to go to college are packing up their bags, they're packing up their notebooks, their computers, and their poker chips. Especially young men, high school and college age young men, it is growing fast. This raises the whole issue of gambling in a new light, and we're going to be talking about that on Thursday. On Friday, we're going to talk about being a mom and whether it's boring. Well, you think that's kind of a strange thing. Where would that come from? Well, it comes from an article written in Great Britain where a woman there wrote an article saying that she is simply bored of being a mother. She thinks it's beneath her dignity and all the rest. It has created an international firestorm for good reason. We're going to be talking about it. Of course, events in the world could come up that would change our schedule, but that's our agenda for the week. And it's going to be fun to look at these things from a Christian worldview perspective. First, to review some of the issues in the news. Of course, the big story is the unfolding of events in the Middle East, especially with Israel's continued incursions into Lebanon. All kinds of stuff about this, by the way, in the news right now, having to do with whether or not this relates to end-stage prophecy. What does this say about the coming of the Antichrist, the coming of Christ, and all the rest? I want to try calmly and deliberatively to address this issue for just a moment. Number one, the main issue right now is the right of Israel as a sovereign nation to protect itself. Before we get to anything else, that is just one of the major facts that seems to be missing from a lot of the conversation right now. We're not talking about what Donald Rumsfeld, our Secretary of State, would call symmetrical warfare here. We're not talking about Israel versus Lebanon. The state of Israel is not at war with the state of Lebanon. The state of Lebanon, by the way, is a very weak government that includes some members of the group known as Hezbollah, which is a terrorist organization. This all began when, a matter of about 2 weeks ago, Hezbollah kidnapped a couple of Israeli soldiers and held them for ransom. Not only that, Hezbollah has been building up rockets and all kinds of armaments. There have been a great deal of harassment across the Lebanese Israeli border. I've been there. Let me just tell you, you're talking about an area of the world that is so small that it is hard for most Americans even to contemplate what we're talking about here. In my view, Israel, number one, has the moral responsibility to defend itself. And it is, again, almost impossible for Americans to understand what that means for Israel, a small nation surrounded by its enemies that have historically claimed the ambition to turn Israel into a non-state, to obliterate and to annihilate the Jewish state. And so this is a nation that, number one, has that responsibility. Number two, just imagine if the United States of America had, on virtually all of its borders, harassment. But on at least a couple of its borders, in this case, the border with Lebanon and the border with Syria, outright problems, outright not only harassment but incursions, outright terror attacks, and all the rest. What if we knew that right across one of our borders, a nation was allowing terrorist camps to build up armaments that would threaten our national security? Well, you know good and well that would not stand. And that is what is happening right now in Israel. Now, there could be all kinds of questions about individual decisions made by the Israeli government, by the Israeli armed forces, the IDF. But the big question here is whether or not a nation has the right to defend itself. And in this case, it is specifically a part of the war on terror, because this isn't symmetrical warfare. This isn't something you can't see. This is the problem when I hear about the United Nations being involved. You know, well, what are you going to do? You could bring in Lebanon and you could bring in Israel and you could try some kind of negotiation. But this really isn't an issue between Lebanon and Israel. It's an issue between Hezbollah and Israel. And, of course, the Lebanese government that has allowed Hezbollah to build up these forces. It's also about the background of Syria and Iran in supporting Hezbollah and giving them armaments and all the rest. What does this have to do with biblical prophecy? I don't know. That is my honest and humble answer. And I am very, very suspicious of anyone who says they know what this means. Because there have been events in the Middle East from, well, you could go all the way back as far as you want in history, and you could say, well, this looks like this, or this looks like that. Here's the formation of the Israeli state in 1948. Well, from 1948 to the present, Israel has never had any sustained moment of peace. It has been one form of military action or potential military action all along the way. And it just seems that every time something like this flares up, there are Christian preachers who will go on the airwaves to say, I know where this stands. I know where the timetable is. I'm not on any countdown, folks, other than this. The Lord Jesus Christ will return exactly as he said he would. Every single prophecy of the scripture will be perfectly fulfilled. And when it happens, all will be amazed. I'll leave it at that. We do need to pray for peace in the Middle East. But let's remember that peace is not merely a ceasefire. It is the establishment of a just peace. It is the establishment of equity and peace and justice. It is not merely the cessation, temporarily for sure, of gunfire. There are all kinds of issues out there, not only in the United States, but in Great Britain. The schools are being told that they will no longer be required to teach children the difference between right and wrong. The government plans to revise the core curriculum, known as the national curriculum in the United Kingdom. And under new wording that reflects a world of relative rather than absolute values, teachers will be asked to encourage pupils to develop, quote, secure values and beliefs, end quote. Well, you know, for the last 30 years or so, maybe even a little bit longer, because I can remember when I was in high school this stuff was going on, there were all these experiments in values clarification. Well, when you hear the word values, just know that generally, if someone is merely willing to talk about values, they're not willing to talk about right and wrong. I mean, after all, Hezbollah values terrorism. They value terror. That is the mechanism of their moral equation. So if you're going to ask a member of Hezbollah to clarify his values, he'll clarify them right quick. His values clarification will be that it is morally right to use violence, whether it's suicide bombing or sending rockets into Haifa or whatever, in order to accomplish his political purposes. Values clarification gets you nowhere. All you do is clarify what someone's values are. That doesn't get you anywhere as an individual, as a family, or as a society towards what those values should be. That is the unavoidable question, and that's why we as Christians have to keep in mind that even when we are caught in a moment of moral ambiguity, and we need to admit that that can happen, we can find ourselves facing a moral situation in which it is not yet clear to us which is right and wrong. It should be clear to us that right and wrong will not be determined by our deciding what's right and wrong, but by a holy God who is himself absolutely righteous. Our values may need to be clarified. That's without question. But not only do they need to be clarified, they need to be rectified. That is to say, our values need to be brought into alignment with exactly where God would have us to be. It is a shame when something like this is institutionalized. Professor Alan Smithers of the University of Buckingham Center for Education and Employment Research says, quote, "The idea that they think is appropriate to dispense with right and wrong is a bit alarming," end quote. Well, I should say so. It's a bit alarming. But a spokeswoman for the National Union of Teachers said, quote, teachers always resented being told that one of the aims of the school was to teach the difference between right and wrong. That is inherent in the way teachers operate. Removing it from the national curriculum will make no difference. But she also said to remove that requirement can undermine children's feelings of security in the country where they are living. Do you have an idea that these people are confused? I think they need, before they get to values clarification, to get some education clarification. What do they think they're doing in teaching children? And how in the world do they intend to conduct any kind of education without talking about right and wrong? If you think I'm wrong about that, well, clarify your values and give me a call. The phone number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. When we come back, we're going to talk about whether or not men should work. That ought to tell us something. I don't know if you saw the New York Times this morning. This really caught my attention. It's an article by two reporters entitled Men Not Working and Not Wanting Just Any Job. And, you know, it's one of those situations in which the newspaper gives you a little clue about what's going on when it puts in the photograph, and the cut line under the photograph identifies a man who just lost his job and decided he wasn't looking for another one. Let me just read to you from the opening of the article. This is the lead in the New York Times today. Alan Bigarreau has stopped looking for work, laid off as a steel worker at 48. He taught math for a while at a community college. But when that ended, he could not find a job that, in his view, wasn't either demeaning or underpaid. So instead of heading for work, Mr. Bigarreau, now 53, fills his days with diversions, playing the piano, reading histories and biographies, writing unpublished Western potboilers in the Louis L'Amour style, all activities once relegated to spare time. He says he stays up late and sleeps in. Quote, I have come to realize that my free time is worth a lot to me, he said. To make ends meet, he has tapped into the equity in his home through a $30,000 second mortgage, and he is drawing down the family's savings at the rate of $7,500 a year. About $60,000 is left. His wife's income helps him scrape by. Quote, if things really get tight, Mr. Bigarreau said, I might have to take a low-wage job, but I don't want to do that. Here's the cut, and this is the point by the reporters. Millions of men like Mr. Bigarreau, men in the prime of their lives between 30 and 55, have dropped out of regular work. They are turning down jobs they think are beneath them, or they are unable to find work for which they are qualified, even as an expanding economy offers opportunity for work. About 13% of American men in this age group are not working, up from 5% in the late 1960s. Let me just stop there. Let's just think demographics for a minute. 300 million Americans, roughly. Just think of how many million American men will be between the ages of 30 and 55. You're talking about a 25-year-old year span there. You're talking about a generation. 13% of them not working at all, not looking for work. Again, you're talking about millions of men. Let me continue from the story. The difference represents 4 million men who would be working today if the employment rate had remained where it was in the 1950s and 60s. Many of these missing men, most, the article says, are former blue-collar workers with no more than high school education, but their ranks are growing at all education and income levels. Refugees of failed internet businesses have spent years out of work during their 30s, while former managers in their late 40s are trying to stretch severance packages and savings all the way to retirement. Now, I think we need to talk about this because looking at this from a Christian perspective, this is not only a failure of economics, a failure of professionalism, a failure of the vocational context. This is a moral failure. In other words, these men who are satisfied not to work because they consider other work beneath them, the available work they could find, and they're just now a piece of themselves not working, I think this is a basic failure of manhood. I think it is a basic failure of the purpose for which these men are supposed to be living. They have responsibilities. I guess I just have to tell you, I was outraged when I saw this man. The picture of him sitting on his front porch, doing whatever he's doing, writing his pot boiler, which is, a book he's supposedly working on, but just piddling around because, as he says, it's all fun now. And they're scraping by, taking a second mortgage on the house, drawing down the family savings, and allowing his wife to work. Boy, that last one just got to me. I mean, what kind of man would willingly allow his wife to work while he sits around, you know, playing tiddlywinks or whatever he's decided to do? This is a basic failure of manhood. Now, folks, the New York Times is onto this because, number one, they see it as politically significant. It probably is. That's not my interest. They also see it as culturally significant. Well, they're on my wavelength there because something is happening when millions of men no longer feel the need to work. Now, I just think back to the men I knew growing up. I go back to my dad and my grandfathers and uncles and all the rest. Not one of them was not a hard worker. And when I mean hard worker, I meant my dad got up so early in the morning, it's hard for me to imagine, and just worked all day. I mean, that's just the way it was. And my grandfathers worked. And you know what? Even when they were retired, they still worked because that's what men do. Now, why do men do that? Well, let's just think back to the covenant that God made with Abraham. Let's think back to the covenant of creation. Let's just think back to the fact that Adam was given the responsibility to till the soil, to work, to labor. And also Adam, because of his sin, was given the curse of having to labor when it meant that it would be by the sweat of his brow, that he would have to earn his keep, that he would have to earn his food, that he would have to till the soil and harvest and weed and do all the things you have to do, because the curse also extended to the earth that no longer willingly gave up its fruit, but now has to be tilled. Well, we know that in the expansion of human experience, we went from agriculture to other kinds of work. But wow, now you have men who just think that they don't have to work at all and evidently are unashamed about it, willing to be photographed on their porch on the front page of the New York Times about it. What do you think about it? The phone number 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I want to tell you, if I lost everything and I didn't have a job, I would find a job doing something. I mean, I would bag groceries. I did that as a teenager. I could do that again. You know, dig holes, do something. It reminds me, by the way, of the parable in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 16, that Jesus tells about the unjust steward. And there's something that's really very interesting about Jesus telling the story. He talks about a man who, of course, was caught being a thief. But when he is caught and he knows he's going to lose his job, he says about himself, "I am too proud to beg and I am too weak to work." And he actually says too weak to dig, just using digging holes as an example of work. I can't imagine a man. I literally find it almost impossible to imagine a man who says, "I just don't need to work. I don't need to make any contribution. Life is just about having fun. And by the way, I'll let my wife work." We got to talk about this. The phone number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. A lot of folks calling in. And by the way, I'm at that stage in the show where I can see all the lines are lit up, but I don't know who it is. I'm wondering right now, are these women calling in about men who aren't working, or are these men calling in about the issue? We're going to find out in just a moment. This New York Times article, by the way, you know, profiles several of these men, and you can understand why. I want to say this. I can understand why some of them would face some real issues. I mean, just the loss of the kind of job you had, the loss of the kind of maybe a salary you had, the loss of the prestige and the pride you had in that work. I can understand that. I can understand steelworkers who say, "Look, I was paid this much, to do that labor, and now the mill is closed. I can't do that anymore." I can understand the pain that's coming in there. What I don't understand is the permanent sense that I don't have to work anymore. Let's go to Barry calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, just to let you know that, you know, I'm in my 40s, and I was laid off from work. You know, everything went. I did everything I could to find a job. And when you look your children in the face and your wife, and you know she tries to do everything to help out as well, you have to keep working. You just can't give in. Even though I felt like giving in, you know, the reason for getting up in the morning is because, one, God gives me the life to breathe, and the second is I have a family to support and to provide for. It's not fair to her because I love my wife as Christ loved the church.
That is really great as a testimony, Barry. I want to ask you a question. I hear the passion in your voice. And let me say, what I hear you saying is that it's incomprehensible to you that as a man you'd simply say, "I'm not going to work anymore."
Exactly. You have to swallow your pride. I know we're men, and we have things that we feel like we have to do. But the thing about it is that when we see who we are accountable to, we have to get up. You know, even though I'm making $28,000 a year, 55, I still have to provide. It isn't much, but bring through it, and God will put me in the place He wants me to be. Not what I want to be, because if I want to be, I'd be sitting on the couch and doing what some of these people that the New York Times had illustrated.
Barry, thank you for an honest word from an honest man. I want to tell you, you mentioned the issue of pride, and I can sense this in your voice. Barry, I think you should feel proud of rising to the moment and taking care of your family. I think pride has to be located in the moral soundness of who we are and what we're doing. Not in a position or in a title or in a job. All that can be taken away from us. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We're talking about men not working. And we'll be right back.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Men not working, that's the concern of the New York Times today. Millions of American men who lost their jobs one way or another and are no longer even looking for work because they consider a job that may pay less or be less significant in their eyes or something else as beneath their dignity, and so they're just deciding not to work, more or less as a permanent state of affairs. Now, I mentioned that that runs right into conflict with the Christian worldview, and I want to set out that theological case for just a moment. We've got calls coming in. We're going to get to the callers in just a moment. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Let me just set the stage here for just a moment. By the way, I'm working on a book based upon my articles from Boy to Man. And, you know, one of the issues of a boy becoming a man is understanding the dignity and the necessity of work, the dignity and the goodness, the moral rightness of labor. And by the way, I know that's hard to get in the minds of a lot of kids today, but that's a different topic for a different day. Right now we're going to be talking about what it means from a Christian perspective for a man just to decide not to work. Number one, in the Old Testament, the Bible consistently dignifies work. The workman is understood as fulfilling a necessary responsibility. The husband, the man, a part of being a man, and certainly a part of being a husband and father in a biblical perspective, and by the way, in the biblical perspective, a man did become a husband and father, except under the most unusual circumstances, is to take his role as a worker and to protect his family and to provide for his family. In the New Testament, it's the same. The workman is worthy of his hire. You have great dignity of work. And then you have outright condemnation of men who will not work, especially within the church. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8, the Apostle Paul writes to Timothy saying, "But if anyone does not provide for his own," that's his own household, "and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." In other words, it is a scandal to the gospel. It is a denial of the faith for a Christian man to fail to provide for his family. Now, this isn't talking about the exceptions where someone's been made medically unable to work or physically unable to work. This is talking about a man who willingly says, "I'm not going to work. I'm not going to take care of my family. Let my wife work. I'm going to sit on the front porch and write novels." Let's go to Johnny calling from Lakeland, Florida, listening to WTBN. Go ahead, Johnny.
Hi. Well, what I want to tell you is I was that man. I lost my CDL, wouldn't take another job. My wife, she got up and went to work for just about minimum wage. We were scraping by, couldn't make ends meet. And I sat home for a year playing video games on the computer. I mean, it was so shameful. And this was about 4 years ago. And when we got our income tax that year from her work, and she gave me my half of the income tax, we always split it, and she gave me half of it, I took that money, went and got my CDL back and told her, "Babe, come back home. I'm going back to work. I'm sorry about this." And ever since then, I've been working out of love for her and my family. And I'm going to tell you, and this is for all the men out there who aren't working, when that happened, my wife has become, out of love, the best homemaker you could ever ask for. She does her part, I my part, and it's right with God's plan. That's exactly what we're doing. She's raising the kids, keeping the house, and I'm going to work every day and providing for my family. And I was her that home.
Hey, Johnny, we lost your signal, but we didn't miss that point. Man, thank you for that testimony. And I love the passion in your voice. You know, Johnny was just so clear. If I still had him and we hadn't lost him, I was going to ask him, when was that aha moment? When all of a sudden did the spark come where he realized it? And I'm assuming CDL's commercial driver's license here. And, yeah, God bless you, Johnny, for getting back to work. And what a great testimony. We was talking about how right it is in his household, how right it is for his wife, how right it is for his kids, and how right it is for him. And right in God's sight. Great point. Let's go to Dave calling from Grand Island, Nebraska, listening on XM Satellite. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, my point basically is that I believe what you're saying, if guys weren't above taking certain jobs, we would not, I think we put the leadership of our country in a quandary to have to allow a certain amount of illegal immigration to take some of the jobs that guys just simply won't take. I started out at 19 years old, cutting meat in a meat plant about 23 years ago, and I drive for Walmart now, and you know, I just feel like there's guys who just won't, they're above that, and that's why, that's the reason we have that problem. And I guess, that's my point.
Yeah, well, and Dave, I think there are a lot of points out there about how people would say, you know, I think this is how we arrived at this point. And there are a lot of contributing factors, and I think you certainly nailed one of them there. I think the big question is, where do we go from here? What about those men who right now are deciding, should I work or not? How do we encourage them to know that it is their responsibility as a man to work? It's their responsibility before God as a man, not only before their families, before their wives, before God, to work. The phone number 877-893-8255. We'll be right back. There are all kinds of dimensions to this. For one thing, you wonder how these people are getting along. The New York Times reports the fastest growing source of help is a patchwork system of government support, the main one being federal disability insurance, which is financed by Social Security payroll taxes. In other words, we're paying for this. The disability stipends range from $1,000 a month, and after the first 2 years, Medicare kicks in, giving access to health insurance that for many missing men no longer comes with the low-wage jobs available to them. No federal entitlement program is growing as quickly, with more than 6.5 million men and women now receiving monthly disability payments, up from 3 million in 1990. About 25% of the missing men are collecting this insurance. Now, the article is very careful. It says, look, some of them may actually be disabled. Some of them may actually have injuries. But it also is very clear, saying that many of them have injuries or complaints that would not normally qualify for disability insurance. Teresa Giladucci, who's a labor economist at the University of Notre Dame, says, quote, we have a de facto welfare system as Europe does, but we're not proud of it as they are. In other words, saying we have a welfare state. That's how these people are getting by, scraping by not working. But whereas Europe says, hey, yes, we want the welfare state. We embrace the welfare state. We're proud of the welfare state. In America, we're not proud of it. We just have it. Let's go to Dee calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Dee.
Well, Dr. Mueller, I just can't help but think that part of this is a result of women for the last 40 years failing to identify our husbands as the hunter-gatherer provider, which is so central to their identity. The feminist movement has said women can do it as well as the men can. Women can make the same money that men can, and we have lost that idea that we have to hold them up as our providers. And so when they run into a stumbling block, they say, okay, I don't have to.
You know, Dee, I think you have nailed it right there. I think that the influence of ideological feminism is really, really potent here. Because the feminists have said, look, there is no distinction between men and women when it comes to labor. And by the way, let me say that there's an obvious dimension here. I just have to say this so everyone can hear me say it, and you know I've said it. This is not suggesting that women who are working in the home aren't working. You know, because on this show, we have dignified that time and time again. I want to dignify the role of the wife and the mother, the housewife, as she is sometimes called, the homemaker, more appropriately. Boy, there's labor there. But that's not the topic we're talking about today. We're talking today about men. And yes, Dee, you're right. When the feminists say there's no distinction between the roles of men and women, then men say, well, all right, then I don't have to be a provider. I don't have to work in labor. If I'm not responsible to take care of these people, if she's just as responsible as I am, let her go out and get the job. Let her go, you know, bag the groceries. Let her go do this. You know, Dee, I really appreciate that because I think ideological feminism is front and center and the target of our concern here. But I want to go back to what Dave said, too, because I think if you put feminism as one contributing cause, and I think for a lot of men it just becomes an excuse, but yes, Dee, you're right, ideology provides excuses. I think what Dave had to say is also really important when he said there have been generations of men who did not consider these jobs beneath their dignity. I think that's really important, too. And how many times do you realize the dignity of the man doing the job that you don't want to do? Now, I'm convicted of that just thinking about it on this program right now. I mean, there are people who have to do jobs we don't want to do. They have to, you know, fix the sewers. They have to fix the cars. You know, they have to go places I don't want to go and do things I don't want to do. They get their hands really dirty. And they do things that a lot of us are glad we don't have to do. You know, Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor, even before he took up that position, was talking about knowledge workers as symbolic analysts. You know, there are those who make their money by thinking and speaking and writing and, developing and inventing and all the rest, and they don't get their hands dirty. But God bless those men who do not consider it beneath their dignity to do whatever they have to do to provide for their families. And God bless them for doing the things that a lot of us don't want to do. And that's one of the things, if you read this article, I'm just thinking of the guy who's out there providing for his family. Think of some of those guys who called in today. They read this New York Times article, and here's this guy sitting on his front porch. That's the picture, the cut line. Alan and Kathleen Begaro have been scraping by since he lost his job in 2001, and he's not seeking work. Well, evidently he considers himself, and I don't know this guy, but just from what you have in the context of the article here, considers himself, too good to do that kind of work. And I want to also say that I can believe that losing a job, losing all kinds of things that come with the job, not only the benefits and the salary, but, the social status and all the rest, that could be devastating to a man. I wouldn't minimize that for a moment. But then to jump to the next step and say, so I'm not going to work anymore, that's just untenable. Let's go to Jason calling from Chattanooga, Tennessee, listening to XM Satellite Radio. Go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, my comment is that part of the problem with our society is that we have got to a point where the man can't really support his family on his own. And I think through that, the wife has got to a point to where she always also has to be to bring income in for the family, and it's causing men to kind of fall behind on that.
Yeah, Jason, you're really onto something there, and I want to expand that a bit, but I want to ask you a follow-up question here. What do you think the answer to that is? If you could just give a short answer, here's how to solve that problem, what would it be?
It's really hard to say. A lot of it has to do with the wages that we can get paid. I mean, we're out there really, for my instance, I have two kids and a wife and a happy family and marriage, but it's really hard for me on my own to go out and to support my family. I guess it's partly just the wages and how our societies came to be to where a man and a woman have to work in order to live and support each other.
All right, Jason, thanks so much for your call. What we have here is the intersection of Dee and Dave and Jason. All of a sudden, we've had these three last callers put it together. Here's the way it works. Back throughout most of the 20th century, the American economy was based upon men working, and the expectation of business is that a corporation or a place of business would provide what was known as a family wage. This goes back to Henry Ford and the Ford Motor Corporation, goes back to the development of heavy industry in America, goes back to the development of labor unions in America. And if you went back to the almost any time until the late 20th century, if you went back to the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, even into the 60s, the expectation would be that a job would allow a man to take care of his family. It was formally known as the family wage. Long before there was a minimum wage, there was that expectation. Henry Ford had that expectation to the point that he wanted a man who worked in his factory to be able not only to support his family, but also to be able to buy one of Henry Ford's own cars. Now, why does Dee's point about feminism come in here? Is it because ideological feminism, politically and culturally, destroyed the idea of the family wage by saying it's not about families, it's about individuals. It's not about men working to support a family, it's about any individual having the right to the same kind of job, the same kind of pay, and the same kind of expectation. Well, if you no longer have a family wage as an expectation, what you have are just workers. Workers, male, female, doesn't matter, just workers. As Jason says, it's hard to put it together when you destroy the family as the basic building block and the family wage as the basic wage. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. I really appreciate the callers and the energy of this conversation today. I think we obviously have struck a nerve. I know when I saw that story this morning, I said, we've got to talk about that. Because it's just one of those things that cries out, here is a major symptom of the dysfunctionality of the way many people are thinking today. The dysfunctionality being men who are just perfectly satisfied not to work. Folks, that idea doesn't work. Not from a Christian perspective. Because the Bible dignifies labor. In fact, the Bible tells us that a part of the purpose which we were created, which means a part of the dimension whereby we glorify God, is in honest work, honest labor, the sweat of our brow, the use of our minds, the energy of our bodies, the work of our hands. You know, the Bible dignifies the work of a man's hands. But the Bible also dignifies the fact that that the church should hold its members accountable for this, that there is a special responsibility of a man. That's what we're talking about here. We're not just talking about, you know, what a woman should do. Boy, we've talked about that a lot, and we'll return to that again. We're talking about now the responsibility, the unique responsibility, the God-mandated responsibility. Well, there's a pun, isn't it? The mandated responsibility of a man to work. It is God's command. To the extent that it becomes a gospel issue. That's what's so interesting. I wonder how many Christians think about this. The responsibility of a man to work, of a husband and a father to provide, is a gospel issue. Now, when we say it's a gospel issue, we mean this. The lack of fulfillment of this responsibility, the disobedience to this command, is a repudiation of the gospel, a public repudiation of the gospel. That's Paul's point when he writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8, when he writes concerning the church, that if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Now, I'm not sure I understand everything Paul is telling Timothy there, but I do understand this. Even unbelievers know that a man has a responsibility to take care of his family. And for one to claim to be a believer in Christ and to fail at that responsibility is to bring disrepute upon the church, in the same sense that a church that tolerates sexual immorality, the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians, is bringing the gospel into disrepute. Here also, it is immoral for a man not to work. That's a strong statement, isn't it? You know, so of course, it's a lot stronger than you would find in any secular editorial because, well, we started out by talking about the British government revising its school curriculum so that there's no longer any right or wrong, and here we are talking about right and wrong. I'm going to end on that note as clearly as I can. It is wrong for a man not to work. Not to support his family. Not to support his wife. Not to support his children. And to be perfectly happy with that. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about who makes the decisions about the medical care of our children. Is it parents? Is it the state? Social workers? Judges? I'll meet you tomorrow. God bless you.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.